Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour, a continuation of our series of conversations with Remarkable Mind. Peter Resnick, Dr. Peter Resnick, one of the leading body, mind, spirit psychoanalysts. He is known and respected because of his gentle approach to helping people better understand the nature, the foundation, the progenitor of their crisis, and therefore reverse engineering the protocols to help them see what they ideally should be, could be, might have been, and so they don't focus undue attention on the crisis and dramas of their life in this moment, but realize this is just a moment in life, and we can use our crisis to become stronger, wiser, and more insightful. And also, Dr. Resnick is going to talk today about what is the central meaning of our lives. Do we even have one? We have suicide at an astronomical level, some of that due to opiates like OxyContin. And others are committing suicide, as many as 20 to 22 a day who've been in war, veterans. They're not being helped. They're just being medicated. In fact, I would dare say, and I'm only speaking for myself, that most of the psychiatric profession, with the best of intents to help, has actually done more harm because they've assumed that a medicated approach, a pharmacological approach, with Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft and Effexor, or even electroconvulsive therapy, that's the tools that they were trained in, that's the tools that insurance reimburses in, and that's the tools they believe actually make a difference. So I'm going to ask Dr. Resnick in a moment, can he cite the examples in the last 50 years of psychiatry as a professional actually reversing in the majority of its patients their underlying what they consider mental illnesses or mental problems? Because right now we have the largest number of people suffering from depression and anxiety in American history. That said, let's go over and see how Dr. Resnick will go about giving us better insights on approaches that are not based upon a pharmacological model of rebalancing our brain chemistry, which itself is a myth, but on more humanistic and spiritual ways. Nice to have you with us today, Peter.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm very happy to be with you today. Can you hear me well?
We can hear you fine. Yes. Peter, it might be of interest for the audience to know how we first met 25 years ago.
Yes,
and
yes.
How that has impacted both of us. So please tell the story.
First, I would like to make a comment, one little correction. I'm not a psychoanalyst. I'm a psychotherapist. There is a big difference because psychoanalysis really is making an attempt to analyze why people are the way they are. And that's their primary focus. And I do exactly the opposite. One of the things I encourage people to do is not to ask why, but to ask what. What can I do to make things better? Because when we begin to ask a question why, it throws us into an abyss, really. It's a question that cannot be really answered. Because to every situation that the person will describe and say, oh, this came from that. Let's say my parents mistreated me, and therefore I'm this way. But maybe, you know, people believe in genetics. Maybe it comes from actually a genetic line. A person is genetically programmed to be a certain way. His father is programmed, his grandfather, and so on. If you believe in past lives, that possibly came from past experiences. So we may never know in truth why we are the way we are. What we can do is acknowledge where we are in the moment and then work on getting to a better place. And that's what I believe, Gary, you have done for 50 years of your life. From what I know, and I know you for 25 years, you meet people where they are, whether it's emotional, mental, physical challenge, and you take them to a better place rather than analyzing how they arrived there. Of course, we need to notice patterns. If a person has not been eating properly, or if a person has been repeating some behavioral pattern, we need to recognize what the pattern is, but then we have to ask a question. What do we do to make it better? And so what I would like to focus on today is on making these changes. But before I would like to, again, before we go into the main subject, I want to make a couple of comments. I guess I said I know you for 25 years, and you, without knowing it, actually forced me to grow. I never had an opportunity to tell it to you, but for 15 years, I worked at the Schachter Center for Complementary Medicine, and Dr. Schachter, Michael Schachter, introduced us. And you said, oh, I would like to interview you. Then you call and say, you know, hello, I am Gary Null. Peter, I would like to interview. And I, of course, with the way I was, at least 25 years ago, that's BGN, before Gary Null, I'm kind of square. I want to know where I'm going, what I'm going to do. And I said, well, what would you like to talk about? And he said, well, you come in and we'll sit in front of each other and I will ask you some questions about your work. So I arrived, I think your office was on Upper West Side. I arrived with a little list of the things I would like to discuss, sit in front of you. I'm expecting exactly what you promised. And suddenly you said, you know something, that's not a good place right now. Let's go for a walk. And I'm screaming inside, what do you mean? I'm prepared for sitting in front of you. I'm prepared with my list. And you take my list and you put it on the table and we walk out. And inside I'm screaming, I'm not prepared. And at that time, remember that you had a cameraman and we were walking in the street on Broadway. And first I was in panic. I'm not prepared. I'm a teacher. I have material that I prepared usually when I teach my classes. But when you started asking me questions and we got engaged, I found I was doing much better without being stiff. And every time you would interview me over the years, whether you invited me to talk on one of your videos or audio radio, I think you were working for WBAI, yes, you would not do what I expected. And even 6 months ago, when you called me, you said, Peter, I would like you to do a radio show. I said, what do you want me to talk about? You said, whatever you want to. I said, but I've never done radio shows. He said, oh, you know, you will do well. And first I thought, how can I do it? But I am doing it actually for 6 months and I love it. And one more little comment. You know, when you offered me to do the radio show, I thought, what is this? I actually never, you know, we haven't spoken for a few years, and I didn't know about PRN. And so I went on PRN, and then I see your show. I recognize Dr. Peter Bregan, whose work I follow for 30 years, ever since I read his book, Toxic Psychiatry. Then Michio Kaku, you know, the explorations. And I realized, you know, I was invited to be in a company. And I know we are approximately the same age. But you guys, you and Dr. Bregan, have been speaking the truth, had the courage to speak to those in power. And these days, actually, it's kind of dangerous. And when I joined PRN, I felt like I was a child, a little boy, permitted to be in the company of grown, courageous men. And I am absolutely thrilled about it. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. I have never heard that story before, so I appreciate the insights.
So
right now, let me just share the larger picture for a moment and then just take it and run with it.
Yes.
By the way, Peter yesterday did a lecture for almost an hour and a half to the anti-aging group. That's where I'm at now. I'm doing a very important anti-aging clinical study with a group of people. And I, at the very first day, I said to them, how many people here are depressed or suffering from anxiety? Every hand went up. And for some of them, it had not started with COVID. It had proceeded for years. One woman said she suffered from chronic depression with some very low points in her life. For the past 30 years, it's destroyed a relationship she had. and friendships, because all she could do is look at the world through a gloom and doom. And she lurched from crisis to dramas, crisis to dramas. And so she saw everything as a scarcity of joy, a scarcity of friends, a scarcity of love, a scarcity of empathy in the world. So whatever was happening outside of herself, she became emotionally. She attached and harmonized with the negative side. So I said to the group, I said, in this entire anti-aging protocol, I will not give a single lecture on anti-aging or on health or on disease. And they're all looking at each other, well, what are you going to talk about? And I said, the core meaning of life, and each of you have to determine what that is to be for you. I mentioned Abraham Maslow, who survived the concentration camps and said that the people most likely to survive were ones who still had something beyond their pain and suffering and torture to live for. And he was right. He was a very powerful voice in the 1940s and 50s. So that's where our journey has begun 2 weeks ago and will continue for another 2 weeks on campus. Now, that said, would you share with this larger audience that we have now all over the world? We're all faced with the same problems. We're all facing Corona. We're all facing different challenges. But what makes what you share unique is that you can share a universal truth that individuals are able then to bring into their own life and then design it in a way that helps them individually. The form is yours.
Well, you brought up, or you asked me to talk about two issues. They are related, but they are separate, huge issues. Actually, three, but I group anxiety and depression as a fix me, how to fix it problem. So it's one issue. And the other issue is meaning in life. That's what you said from the beginning. Viktor Frankl wrote a wonderful book, Man's Search for Meaning. And what he discovered, and he was a psychiatrist from Switzerland, who also spent 4 years in concentration camp, and he discovered that people who lose meaning in life die. People who had, in such horrific circumstances, people who had meaning survived. Whether meaning was, you know, I want to survive and see my grandchildren or my children, or I want to see my persecutors in jail or killed, whatever meaning was there, propelled them to withstand this horrific circumstances. So to having meaning is absolutely essential. I've been working, as you know, for 43 years with people, and I find that, and you know, I half of my practice is psychology and half is working with physical illnesses. At the Shakta Center, I worked with a lot of cancer patients and people who had meaning. Everybody has some kind of meaning, but people who had this burning desire, I want to achieve this. I want to raise my grandchildren. I want to play with my children. I want, did much, much better than people who just were terrified by their disease. And numerous studies from around the world actually show that our emotional state doesn't necessarily always cause the illness, but is always one of the major contributing factors to any physical illness. In fact, the father of Western medicine, Hippocrates, said 2,500 years ago, I would rather know what sort of a man has a disease than what sort of a disease a man has. So he understood that one's mental, emotional, social, spiritual being, one's way of being is as or even more important than the symptom itself. So in this short interview, I cannot, of course, guide people how to find meaning in life, even though I've seen a number of people who come to see me, not because they have some emotional issues or physical problem, but precisely because of that, they're searching for meaning. which is already a wonderful thing, because searching for meaning is meaning by already. So there are many interesting ways to search for meaning and to find the answer, what is here I'm for? And as you said, Abraham Maslow was a brilliant, brilliant psychologist, and one of, along with Carl Rogers, were one of the founders of what is called now humanistic psychology. And rather than dealing with pathology, with pain, with what is not working, they said, let us look of what makes people healthy, what works for them. That is a very interesting question. Because they, most of the time people study, doctors study pathology. For example, people laying asphalt is not a good thing for your health. Asphalt is carcinogenic, and people who work putting down asphalt, some get lung cancer. The question is, what about, you know, not everyone who works putting down asphalt gets cancer, maybe one of 20, one of 30. So the question is, what is the difference between this person and those who don't get cancer? The same thing with any illness. So that's probably just simply a good question to ask. Because another thing, and it may be interesting for our listeners, Dr. Carl Hans did an incredible, incredible, Hans Eysenck, English psychologist, Hans Eysenck did an incredible study where he worked with 17,000 people, and he split them in three groups. One group that he had in extensive questionnaires, and he identified as people who are anxious. The second group he identified as people who were depressed. And the third group, people who were what Abraham Maslow would call self-actualized, were satisfied with their life, had meaning in their life. And these people were followed for 15 years. And when I tell you the numbers, it's shocking. It was shocking for me to read the study, and I read it maybe 30 years ago. What he found 15 years later, that 75% of people from this huge group of 17,000 people, 75% of people who had heart attacks were from anxious group. 75% of people who ended up having cancer were from the depressed group. Only 1.5% of people from let's call it healthy or self-actualized people had either cancer or heart attack. Isn't that incredible? Now, I don't own any stock for tobacco companies, trust me, but I want to tell you something even about smoking. What he discovered was 16% in 15 years, 16% of all people who developed lung cancer were either from depressed group or from anxious group. Only 0.4% of smokers developed from a happy group developed cancer. Isn't that incredible? Do you hear me? Are you with me?
Yes. Yes, yeah. I'm listening.
Isn't it shocking?
Yes.
It's so important that, Gary, that you brought up this question. Let's talk about anxiety and depression, because that's how devastating they are. Now, first thing I would like people to become aware, if they're not aware of it yet, is that anxiety and depression are not psychological problems. They are not psychiatric problems, even though they are treated as psychiatric and psychological problems. They are problems of the human organism. They are problem of a whole human being. And anxiety or depression are manifested in a human being on different levels. They are manifested in the body and in our feeling apparatus and emotional apparatus. Why I make the difference? Because sometimes people confuse the word feeling and emotion. The word emotion comes from Latin word imovere, which means to move out of. In fact, sometimes people are not very emotional and their friends or relatives say, oh, this person doesn't feel, you don't see him react anyhow. He may feel very intensely. He just doesn't emote it. He doesn't show what he feels, but he may be a very sensitive person. So what I'm saying is, human organism is assaulted by something, by some environmental issue or by a physical event. Any physical event reverberates in a human organism as a feeling, or every feeling becomes embodied. I'll give you an example. If people have constipation, they go to see a physician. But if people are depressed, they go to see a psychologist. But it's the same issue. Why? When the person is depressed, what happens? They hold on to the past. They hold on to some sad events, hold grudge against someone, feel bad, feel sorry, feel remorseful. They're holding on. And as they're holding on emotionally and mentally, they're holding on physically. They cannot let go of what? Of feces. It's stuck. You know, how do you call it? Letting go of shit, right? That's the expression in English, right? So you are literally, your colon is constricted and you cannot let go of stuff. You will find sometimes people come to see me, a person is overweight. And I say, and they come because they want to lose weight. And I begin to talk about their emotional life very often. They're depressed. And you will say, oh, no, yeah, they're depressed because, of course, they're depressed because they're overweight. No, it's the human organism holding on. Because then I say, tell me, how many extra things you have in your closet? And they say, what do you mean? What I'm hiding inside of me? No, I say in your physical closet. How many extra shoes that you're not wearing anymore, dresses or suits you have that don't fit you and you will never wear? And they say, how do you know? You have a camera following me? You've seen my closet? I say, no. Because if you're holding on, you're holding on every level. So, and one of the assignments I may give to people is go and let go of things at home or in your closet. Then I ask them to write a list of hurts and guilts, because most of the time they're holding on. They hold a grudge against people. They're holding on to some hurts and memories from the past. Things happen. Remember Forrest Gump, what he said? Shit happens. This is life. Anything can happen and does. And what happens then? You live with it. People say, oh, I don't have energy, I'm drained. People who are anxious or depressed. Gary, you worked with these people. By the way, thank you so much. It's you, William and Rich. When I gave this talk yesterday, they were so nice. They turned the television. People could see me. I could see them. We interacted. It was very nice. So I was actually asking them, like, lift your hand if you have these attachments to some things in your mind, in your past. And almost everyone lifted their hands. I want you to think about energy. And I'm sure, Gary, in your workshop, you talk about it. And people say, you know, I don't have the energy. Somehow my body doesn't work. I am telling you, and please don't take my word. Nothing, ladies and gentlemen, nothing of what I tell you is true, unless it is true to you. But the only way you will know whether or not what I have to say has any value is if you go and try it out. And what I'm telling you, try it out. You have all the energy. Call it God-given, call it energy from universe, nature. we have everything that we need to repair our body. But what happens? Where is this energy? If I'm so drained, if I'm so tired, it hurts here, I cannot stretch, I cannot move. Because you give away energy. Yeah, in addition, of course, you have to have a good diet, and that's what Gary will teach you. You know, he knows all about nutrition for the case. But still, think about energy. Energy is flow from life, from nature. And we are getting exactly, not less, not 1 inch less, exactly as much energy as we need to repair whatever damage we do in our to our body, when we fall down, when we run too fast, when we overwork, we absolutely get the right amount of energy. But you will say, where is that energy? I will tell you where. Think or imagine yourself as a battery, a perfect battery, and there is a perfect flow of energy from above, from nature, from air. Doesn't matter. But now I want you to think of a little cable going from your battery and goes to the left. Follow the cable. It's attached to a small battery. That battery is called my brother who was beating me up when I was a child. Then you see another cable and it's attached to another little battery and it's called I was not treated well in school. Kids bullied me. And there is another battery in another cable, and that is the future story. My son will get sick, or he will get old. What will we do? My mother is aging. What will I do? And that's another battery. And if you see now, think of how many cables and how many batteries. And each cable takes battery energy from your battery, and it feeds that little battery that what you created, that story. You feed those stories and they are alive. But this, now imagine, those batteries are not simple batteries. It's like living beings that you created. And in Paris, they have Notre Dame de Paris, the great cathedral. And on top, there are these little evil creatures, if you have been to Paris. They're called Igogors. And the designer understood, and the church understood hundreds of years ago, that these Igogors are man-made demons. It's our creation. Whether it's fear, anxiety, it's some resentment, some remorse, some bad memories that we're feeding. We create those batteries or beings, but it's better to have an analogy of being, because anything you create, it's like your creation, it's a living being. It needs your energy and attention. Excuse me. And once they're alive, whether you want or not, cables are created and they're sucking energy out of you. That's where your energy. So that's why you may have half or quarter energy and you're drained. So you need to start working. And when I say, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to know, we are all in the same boat. We're human family. We're different only in a degree, not in kind. When I say you, don't think that I do not deal with the same issues. And I have tools, of course, you know, my radio show at PRN is called Dr. Peter Resnick's Toolbox. Why? Because I accumulated a lot of tools over the years of dealing with all these issues. But frankly, it doesn't mean I'm a master. I'm just a teacher. A master is a person who mastered all the things that he or she teaches. But I am not a master. Some issues that you dealt with and already conquered, I'm still working on. And some things, because I have all the tools available, I mastered to a greater degree. So we're all in the same boat. As I said, we are different only in a degree, not in kind. So But those of you who are dealing with sadness, with heaviness, first I would suggest you write two lists. One for hurts and one for guilt. One that you feel guilty about or remorseful about. And you examine each. And you look first at the list of the hurts. And go over each of them. Have a little private time. Possibly light the candle. Read every one of them aloud. Feel the pain and frustration of it. And after that, say, I forgive you, whoever hurt you, for having done this to me. And I forgive myself for being a part of it. And then you cross the list. You read the next one. I forgive, and I forgive myself. Every one of them. When you are finished, you burn the paper. I burn it on an aluminum foil plate, not a good plate, because oils will ruin your plate. And then when only ashes are left, you go to the bathroom and flush them down the toilet. Then walk out of the bathroom as you close the door behind you. Close your eyes for a moment and see yourself being a bird. And from that point on, any time in the future, if you ever think about that particular hurt, remember, the thought may come, but you give life to it, and it becomes that one of those batteries again, if you give it more than 1.5 seconds. I don't have time to go into why, but studies actually show that the speed of a thought is 1/150th of a second. So you have no control over going. You have no control over the thought coming, but you have control. And it is your responsibility what you do with that thought. And as I said, if you give it your energy for 1.5 seconds, if you begin to think about it, the cable is created, the battery is created, now you have another egregore, another demon that sucks your energy. No. The moment you become cognizant that you think about one of those hurts, for a split second you close your eyes and see the ashes being sucked down the toilet. The ashes being sucked down the toilet. This is it. This is it. And if you say to me, I cannot let go of this hurt, this was really wrong. What was done to me? If this is the past, I am telling you, let it go. Not for the sake of that person, but for the sake of you living, going on with your life. I'm so compelled to tell you, it just came to me, to tell you a story. Why it is so important to let go of hurts. Please pay attention to the numbers. It's significant. In 2004, and I tell this story whenever it comes to my mind when I lecture, 2004, I was driving a car, a long drive, and I think it was on National Public Radio. A man was interviewed, and it was 2004, it was 60th anniversary of liberation of Auschwitz. And the man said, I am 80 years old. When I was brought to Auschwitz, that is, remember, 2004, he was 80, right? He said, when I was brought to Auschwitz, I was 16 years old. I was brought in with my family, my mother, my father, sisters and brothers. I spent 4 years in a camp, and everyone is perished. I'm the only survivor. When I was 20, we were liberated. That was 1944. And for the following 40 years, he said, I created Auschwitz on my own. I lived in the camp. I lived with anger. I was married 3 times. My children and 3 times divorced. Had children from different wives. My children didn't want to talk to me because I was such an angry, angry human being. And so I turned 60. And that means it was 19... he turned 60 in 1984. He said it was 1984 and I was a miserable human being, lonely, full of hatred. And I wanted to end my life. And something came to me from nowhere. Go to Auschwitz. And I thought, how? Why would I go to Auschwitz? And I had nothing else to do. So he said, I decided to go to Auschwitz. And I arranged, there was a hotel somewhere, a reserved hotel for several days. I flew to Poland and slept overnight in the hotel. And in the morning, it was early morning, foggy, went to Auschwitz. And there were still no visitors. It was like 10 o'clock or whatever, 11. They opened the Auschwitz, the museum, and I went in. And I walked from barrack to barrack, and I found mine. And I found even and recognized the wooden bed or whatever. It was several layers where people were lying, my place. And said to myself, what am I doing here? And again, he said, something propelled me to go to the plaza, to the plaza where they would line people out. And at the end of the day, they would walk and see who is already so frail that was to go to die and who would still go on. And I was standing there alone. And then suddenly I heard myself scream up into the sky, I forgive you. And I screamed again, I forgive you. And he said, when I screamed, I suddenly felt that this weight of all the years fell off me. And I had nothing to do there. He said, I went back to the hotel, packed, came home. It was 1984. And he said, for the last 20 years, I have been a happy man. I reconnected with all my children. I apologized to them and to my ex-wives. And I live in peace. And this is the story, ladies and gentlemen. I didn't plan to tell it to you. But that's, if he could have the I don't know where it came from, the power to forgive that. And again, it wasn't to forget what John Kennedy, I think, said, forgive those who hurt you, but don't forget their names. He knows who hurt him, but there is no more pain and anger toward those people. And if you are at all, those of you who are listening, have, you know, you're connected spiritually, if you are religious at all, you know that we are taught in spiritual traditions to forgive. Particularly that if a person who hurt you did anything good to you. That's by the way, how I came to forgiveness. For my family, my father's family, 10 brothers and sisters were killed during the World War II. And then he came back after the war. He was married and had a wife and 2 children. And they showed him, neighbors showed him where his wife was hanging, on what pole, and on what poles his 2 sons were hanging. And he got married to my mother, and my brother and my sister and I were born. So my mother went through 2 years of concentration. And I went through horrific things. My family went. I tell you how I found forgiveness also. Because for when I was a teenager, I grew up on stories of my mother after escaping from the camp. She did, hiding on the roofs of abandoned buildings, and at night coming out to fight with rats for garbage so they could survive. So I grew up on those stories, and I grew up with a lot of anger and resentment. And then I realized, you know, I started reading the Bible, actually, and in the Bible it's written, you will not hate the Egyptians. Remember, the Egyptians enslaved the Hebrews for hundreds of years. And yet it's written, do not hate the Egyptian, for you were a stranger in their land, because Egyptians first welcomed the Hebrews and they were not oppressing them. So the same thing, Hebrew people, Jewish people prospered in the land of Germany and they were having prominent positions, they lived good lives. So out of gratitude, we cannot take away all the good that Germans did, but because of 4 years of slaughter. So that helped me to deal with my past. So the same thing, if somebody did anything good, that's particularly easy to let go, because not because of what you hate, but because you what you appreciate. In fact, in Christianity, Jesus taught, do not fight the evil, strengthen the good. So that's regarding the past and how you release the hurts. Now the guilt. The guilt, literally, the word guilt comes from German word Schuld, which means debt. So it's easier to pay the debt than to carry the burden of the debt unpaid. So it's very important not to carry the burden of guilt. In fact, the wonderful psychiatrist, may he rest in peace, David Hawkins, created a hierarchy of feelings, and he identified guilt as being the heaviest, the most devastating. And my teacher of blessed memory, Colette, believed that emotional foundation of all physical illnesses is guilt. So, and in my experience, it has been also true. All people, all cancer patients that I saw at the Shakta Center, so many carried guilt. Not all. There were other things that maybe on another talk I will talk about it, about cancer and what I learned from my experience working with it. But it's super important to let go of guilt. So how you do it? You pay the debt. That is, the easiest is if you stole, you pay back. If you broke something, you destroy something, you try to rebuild it. If you hurt someone's feelings, you pick up the phone and you say, I wronged you, I apologized. You don't say, please forgive me, because now you wronged them and now you're asking them for something. No, your job is to say, I wronged you, I apologized. Now it's not on you, it's on them. Whether they want to forgive you or not, it's up to them. But you let go of that. But if you say, what if a person, I don't know where the person is, or a person is dead, then my suggestion is you make a donation to the cause that this person would appreciate. Something like, you know, if a person is religious, you go to the church and make the donation, you light the candle. There are also, I have to mention, false guilts. Sometimes a person makes up a story and believes that he wronged somebody, he is not sure. Then I would suggest that you talk to three people who are your real friends, meaning friends who don't just say, oh, you're wonderful, I love you, but will tell you the truth. And if three people say, no, that's not your fault, you're not in debt, you're not guilty of that, then you trust them. Or they may say yes. So what, remember, and you go one by one with these guilt and do the same thing then. You cross each after you finish. So dealing with guilt may take you a longer time. And then you burn the paper and you flush it down the toilet. Again, you walk out of the bathroom, close your eyes, see yourself as a bird. And from that point on, if any time you think about that, whatever that or guilt you may think about, as soon as you can close your eyes and imagine this ashes being sucked down the toilet. So this is just about dealing with depression, as you understand, because guilt, remorse, sadness, carrying on, holding on to these hurts and guilts, major contributors to depression, which then in the physical body is expressed as multitude of physical illnesses, because the body is always manifesting as absorbing your feelings. Now we have only 10 minutes left to deal with anxiety, and this is a huge, huge subject, so I will try to be short. By the way, Latin root for the word anxiety literally means, it comes from angst, which means to choke. And if you know, when you are anxious, you cannot breathe. You're choking. Oh, something came to me, by the way, I don't want to forget. We'll get back to anxiety. About depression, if you want to know a little bit more about depression, read my article. You can go on my website. Gary, can I give my website?
Yes, of course.
DrPeterResnik.com. Dr. Peter, then another R-E-Z-N as Nancy, I-K.com. You go under articles. I have many articles there. And one of the articles is called Lifting the Burden, because depression comes from Latin depressio, which means the burden, pressing. So Lifting the Burden, notes on overcoming depression. So I elaborate on that there, because otherwise you feel depressed, you go to see a doctor, and the doctor says, you have chemical imbalance. You need medication. Nonsense. There is no such thing as chemical imbalance, because if you are depressed, if you are sad, your brain chemistry for sure changes, but changes appropriately to being sad and feeling bad. And so you need to learn tools to feel better and to change your life. Otherwise, they really create a chemical imbalance. They give you medication that makes you pretend that you makes you feel different, but you are disconnected from you because nothing changed in your life. I, by the way, got a lot of heat for that because of that article, because some people have published it somewhere, I don't know, on a website, and they wrote, you don't know anything about depression, it's a chemical imbalance. No, it's not a chemical imbalance. It's totally chemically appropriate response when your brain changes the chemistry, when you are sad. So you need to learn how not to be sad. The same thing with anxiety. You're not out of balance. If you are anxious about something, of course your brain chemistry changes. Norepinephrine is flowing in your brain, which stimulates your heart rate. And so let's go back to anxiety. So anxiety, again, it's also a physical event. It's not just mental. And because we are spiritual, emotional, mental beings that live in a physical body, and it's a final product, the first thing to do is to identify where in the body you feel that anxiety. So if those of you who experienced anxiety know, it's like you either feel burning in your chest, it's hard to breathe, you're choking, or you feel tension in your neck, you feel tension all over in your head. Some people talk about head tingling, your shoulders are in pain, or your stomach is tight. Wherever you identify it, here, because we have little time, I give you a specific tool. Remember it, or probably Gary will have it on his website. Listen to it again. Here is what you do. It's step by step. I tell you, one step after the other. Excuse me, I have a sip of water. Number one, once you feel anxious, you accept that you are anxious. Remember, you cannot disown what you don't own. You have to accept you're a human being, thank God you're alive, and therefore you're feeling. And right now you're feeling anxious. So you say, I am anxious. And that is okay to be anxious. Then you identify, that's step number one. Step number two, you identify where you feel your anxiety in the body. Now, if you are not in front of people, you place your hand on that part of your body. And if you are with other people, it kind of would be a little strange, so then you don't do it. But if you can, you put your hand on that part of your body, like whether it's on the chest, on your stomach. So that's step three. And then, this is super important to remember, you slowly breathe out, not in. When people tell you when you're anxious, take deep breath, they do you a disservice. Because when you take a deep breath and inhale, you stimulate your sympathetic nervous system. But it's when you exhale, you stimulate your parasympathetic nervous system. It stimulates your quieting nerve called vagus, which goes from your brain, from medulla to heart, lungs, and stomach. So you will say, how can you exhale without inhaling? Very, very well. I will tell you, for example, we speak on exhalation. Look, I'm talking and I still will have something to exhale. Watch. And it's after a whole few sentences, right? So what I want you to do, remember fourth step, once you identify, put your hand and then slowly breathe out through your mouth. Then normally through your inhale through your nose, exhale through your mouth, inhale through your nose, exhale through your mouth, inhale through your nose. And then watch, I'm thinking how far I want to take you. Preferably, when you identified it's a little bit now higher level of mastery. When you identify that you're anxious, for a split second, ask yourself, what's the number? And that is, what is the number in hierarchy from 1 to 10, as 10 being totally out of control? So ask yourself, what's the number? And you will see, don't think intellectually, some number will pop up. Let's say number 7 or number 8. So then when you begin to breathe out, keep that number in mind, in front of you. Keep breathing out and in. Slowly you will see, like in a meter in a car, the number will go from 7 to 6. Boom. Keep breathing. Watch the number. Don't do anything to that number. And at one point you will see it will click to boom, 5. Once it goes to 5 or less, you can stop. That's the exercise for anxiety. Again,
Peter, we're going to have to continue at another time. We have a lot more to talk about, but we're out of time for this hour.
Yeah, okay.
I thank you very much for sharing these really deep and gentle messages for us. For all the people who are depressed and anxious, please re-listen to this as often as it takes. Dr. Peter Reznik, that's R-E-Z-N-I-K, and you can read one of his books. He's the author of a forthcoming book, Six Pillars of Well-Being. He is the host of the Peter Reznik Toolbox that airs every Tuesday at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Reader Network, and his website is GPSF or health.com. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.